Well, good morning, everyone. How are we all doing today? Guys, open up to Daniel, chapter 4. Likely finish chapter 4 today. Okay, so remember, Daniel is not written chronologically, so we will not be going through the book numerically. Chapter 4 is where we will stop and then jump on over to chapter 7, cover chapter 7 and 8, and then we'll come back to chapter 5. And I think by the end of class, maybe I'll put that back up on the board, just why that split is the way that it is. But what we've covered in chapters 1 through 4, chapter 1, Nebuchadnezzar, right, meets God's people. In chapter 2 is the dream of the statue, which is largely prophesying the number of kingdoms until the church is established by Jesus. And then in chapter 3, the fiery furnace, right, for Daniel's buddies. And then in chapter 4, the king has another dream, only this one different, about a big tree that was mighty and powerful, and it gets chopped down. But that if the tree can recognize that it's heaven that rules, then the tree will be given back. So prophesying the period of insanity of King Nebuchadnezzar, God is humbling him. So we're in the middle of that. Let's just take a few short minutes here to recap what we covered last week. If you look in Daniel chapter 4, verse 26, Daniel explaining to the king the meaning of the dream. In verse 26, it says, in that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize that it is heaven that rules. Therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins by doing righteousness and from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, in case there may be a prolonging of your prosperity. So there are a couple, you know, main points that we hit here. In verse 26, as a part of this dream, it is also promised that the kingdom would be returned back to Nebuchadnezzar. We have to remember that God is bringing judgment on King Nebuchadnezzar, largely for his arrogance. And so God's judgment is intended to humble the king, not harden the king. So to do that, he says, I'm not just bopping you on the head. I'm trying to give you a little wake-up call. And once you wake up and call on heaven's dominion and not your own, you can have your kingdom back. And so that's why that is in there. And then the next thing here in verse 27, Daniel throws in and, you know, he says, my advice is stop sinning so that it may be well with you. And that's happened before. I always think of Nineveh, where God had pronounced judgment against Nineveh. And the message was repent and God will relent concerning the calamity which he has prophesied against this city. And that's exactly what happened. Okay, the last chapter of Jonah is a little discouraging, but you know, up until that, pretty good story. King Hezekiah found himself in a similar situation where he basically was given a death sentence. Okay, and should he kind of get the ship going, maybe in a more righteous direction, God added years of life and healed him from his ailment. So that would be the hope here, is that the king would stop from his sinning. Now, that's largely what we covered 2 weeks ago, but I'm sure the family camp message is probably already starting to become a little fuzzy and starting to, you know, oh, who said that? One of the messages, and there were many, okay, and I think I still have goosebumps after Mr. Doty's message, so he has a way of doing that at family camp, you know. One of the ones that I really, really appreciated was Mike Martin, okay, and I don't know if you guys remember. But he was given the task of Babylon, okay, in the book of Revelation. And so what he did is he went back to Genesis, which we'll do this morning, and he showed the beginnings of Babylon. And we need to do that for our class here this morning, okay? But one of the things that he did is he went to Isaiah 47. And before we turn there, in verse 27 of our chapter, Daniel's advice, he says, my advice is that you stop sinning so that, you know, maybe the tree doesn't come tumbling down. You know, maybe that there is a, you know, God relents concerning the calamity. And then, did you notice what he specifically mentions would be a good start? Did you guys see that in verse 27? Why don't you do righteousness? Turn away from your sin, your iniquity, and start being nice to the poor people. Okay, well, no shocker there, right? Now, I'm sure this wasn't the only thing on the list of Nebuchadnezzar's iniquities, but it is the one that gets mentioned. But isn't that what rulers do? Is oppress the poor? They always overwork them and underpay them. And they always take it, okay. And the poor don't have affluence, so they can't rise up and rebel against the system, okay. And then when there gets to be too many of them, like in the case of the Israelites, that now you got something to work with, okay. But that's all you got is just sheer numbers. And if you don't have those numbers on your side, man, those who are in power, they can keep you poor. But that's what rulers do, right? Probably going to need to preach a message on this, but where you have large groups of people gather on the earth, wickedness always sifts its way to the top, right? And the reason, and this is something I said a couple weeks ago, the reason why wickedness is able to sift itself to the top and separate itself from the rest is because wickedness is willing to do what righteousness is not, which is steal, kill, and destroy. So when you're ready to do that, and you'll take out anybody who or anything that is in your way, well, it's pretty easy to rise to the top of power, okay? But the only way to get there is to trample on the poor along the way. So that's what the king had done, okay? You go back to Isaiah chapter 47. One of the things that we've talked about quite a bit in this class is the nature of Jeremiah's prophecies concerning this time when Israel would go into Babylonian captivity. Jeremiah spoke of it. And the message was what? I really want you to think about this. God knew that the Israelites were going to go into Babylonian captivity. What was the general message from God? Was it A, fight the Babylonians, and if you lose, then you lose? Or B, go willingly, have families, plant gardens, and buy houses. Which one? A or B? B, okay. So what we see in Isaiah 47, now I don't know what the title above your chapter says. I don't have those, and I get to write my own, which I find very fun to do. And I just wrote the coming Babylonian destruction, okay. So although the message is go to Babylon and be nice to Babylon, because if Babylon prospers, you will prosper. And that's a good thing because God needs his people to not die so that way he can bring about the Messiah. If God's people just die in Babylon, there is no Jesus. So if Babylon does well, then you do well. That's important to God's plan. But that doesn't mean God's still not going to destroy Babylon when he's done with her. Mike Martin's message, okay? That's why I really appreciated it. So, the prophets do prophesy of Babylon's destruction. So even though in this class it's looked like God has, you know, built up Babylon, you know, and told his people to encourage the welfare of Babylon, that is only so the Israelites live. And that way, when the Israelites live, there will be a lineage to get to Jesus, okay? But once he's done with Babylon, she's going down, okay? And so that's, you can see all the imagery for the church and the world. And when God's done with the world, it's going down. But the verse that he read in Isaiah 47, let's start in verse 4. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, the Holy One of Israel. Sit silently and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you will no longer be called the Queen of Kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage and gave them into your hand, and you did not show mercy to them. On the aged, you made your yoke very heavy. I was like, wow, that sounds a lot like what Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 4. So you have this really cool section where God's saying, Babylon, I'm going to judge you. And yeah, you're the queen of the nations, okay, but you're not going to be able to have that title for much longer because I'm going to pronounce judgment on you. And then what reason does he give? And I want us to see this, because this is the reason why God judges the world. What reason does he give in Isaiah for pronouncing judgment against Babylon? He says, you did not treat my people well. Yeah, I sent them into captivity. I was angry with my people. I profaned my heritage. But when I sent them, you treated them poorly. Now, Babylon represents what? We're fresh from the apocalyptic family camp, right? What does Babylon represent? I already saw someone word it. The world. And God judges the world. There was a message on the trumpets of judgment, right? Okay. God judges the world because it would dare lift up its hand against the church. And so that's going on here 700 years before Jesus arrives on the scene in Isaiah. But what I thought, and so that's Mike's message, okay? But what's really cool here is when you whittle it down, he gives us a specific accusation for how Babylon mistreated his people. And it was, in the end of verse 6, on the aged, you made your yoke very heavy. Okay? Now, that's not saying the aged and the poor are the same thing, but those do overlap. Okay? But how did he oppress the aged? By making the yoke heavy. How do you oppress the poor? The exact same way. You overwork them and you underpay them. Now, how much were the Israelites making per brick there in Egypt? It's called maybe a splash of water at the end of the day if you're lucky. Okay. Daniel chapter 4. I was really looking forward to bringing that in once I saw that. It was the first time I had noticed that specifically, the prophecy of Babylon tying directly to Daniel chapter 4. So I was pretty excited to bring that out. But the real reason for the excitement is, like, it just, this stuff really gets me fired up because, man, God is real. He is the author of this book. He has made us in his image, and he has a plan for our life. Amen? And there are so many things in this life designed to make us waver from that picture and to rely on ourselves instead of relying on God, or to take vengeance into our own hands rather than letting that lie in the hands of God, you know, whatever it may be. And these things are like, man, you look Isaiah, Jeremiah, writing in two different time periods. You have Daniel, and then you have the writings of the New Testament confirming, and they're like this puzzle that just goes perfectly together. And God's predicting it every step of the way. Yep, I'm going to punish my people for not following me, but I'll send them into Babylon, but I won't destroy Babylon right away, but I will later because they were not good to my... And every one of these happens exactly the way God said it would. Back to chapter 4 here in Daniel, verse 28. It said, all this happened to Nebuchadnezzar the king. 12 months later, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. Ample time given to repent. Ample time to stop oppressing the poor given. A year? Yeah. Sufficient. So what's he doing? Is he... What's he doing? I mean, why would you be on the roof of your palace in the first place? Deep in thought? Just had to get away for a moment? Taking a survey, Rain. of your mighty kingdom. Yeah. Ah, too bad, Nebi. Well, this has been emotional struggle for me, you know? I mean, I want this guy to win. We want everyone to win, don't we? And he's just so close. But he just can't get out of his own way. Verse 30, the king reflected and said, here's his survey. Is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty? While the word was in the king's mouth, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is declared sovereignty has been removed from you. And you will be driven away from mankind, and your dwelling place will be with the beasts of the field. And you will be given grass to eat like cattle, and 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. That's what the statue in chapter 2 was supposed to do. Just saying. Immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. So, yeah, plenty of time given for the king to take Daniel's advice to maybe turn from his iniquity and stop oppressing the aged and the poor, and then along with maybe, you know, whatever else he was up to. And he clearly doesn't, okay? And this was, you know, we read this a couple weeks ago, so we don't need to read it again, but history does say that Babylon did grow tremendously under King Nebuchadnezzar's rule, but he wasn't even the king that, like, captured Jerusalem. That was his father, okay? And so he's on the roof of his palace, and he's looking and he says, look at what I have built. Well, how far back in the Old Testament can we go until we actually find the actual building of Babylon? Do you guys remember? Yeah. Genesis. And not like, you know, Genesis chapter 40. You know, chapter 10. And, I mean, even just a few chapters earlier, it is called the Tower of Babel. So it's like, I mean, these origins go way, way back. So for the king to stand there and say, look at this kingdom that I have built, it's in here to show that the arrogance is definitely spewing. So while the words were in the king's mouth. So I think that's important. Because it's been a year, and the guy's probably been arrogant the whole year, right? But while the words are in his mouth, the voice comes from heaven saying, your sovereignty has been removed from you because God's the one who gave it to you, and God can take it away, right? You go to Jeremiah chapter 27. Wish I could think of a good example here, but by having the sentence pronounced right in the middle of the king's words is connecting, is appropriately connecting the punishment to the crime. That makes sense. Okay. I can't think of a good example. Sometimes you have little ones and, you know, maybe they knocked something over, but, you know, you catch them a few minutes later and you say, well, why were you... Ethan likes to do this because he's too smart for his own good, but he's got to learn, you know, he knows how to get me on the details. Well, why were you in the living room by yourself and doing that thing? And he's like, I wasn't by myself. But you still did the thing. See, you see how easy it is to take the thing that happened and in the right context shed to another detail of the story to remove the accountability? Okay, it's not a good enough example. I can't think of one. But by the by the sentence being pronounced right in the middle of his words, it's appropriately connecting the punishment to the crime, which is his arrogance. Okay? Because there's all sort, I mean, right? Because how, I mean, if God doesn't do that, then the king could be like, well, I'm being punished because of my good looks, you know. Well, I mean, people do really interesting justifications for, like, their actions, you know. Well, I'm being punished, you know, and, you know, well, I would, you know, and so he makes it really clear. Right when he's in the middle of being arrogant, saying something that isn't his to say, that's when it comes. Okay, so I wish I had a better example, but, you know, but the point is he says, your sovereignty has been taken from you. Okay, because God gives it and God can take it away. Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 6, he says, now I have given all these lands. God's talking to his people, telling them to go willingly into Babylon. I have given all these lands into the hand of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. Sorry, Nebi, you didn't build it. God allowed you to have it. He gave it to him. Just like you're going to give it to Cyrus, right? My servant, I have given him also the wild animals of the field to serve him. All the nations shall serve him and his sons and his grandson until the time of his own land comes. That was Isaiah 47. So many nations and great kings will make him their servant. Okay? So God gives and God can take it away. Now, I want us to go to Luke chapter 12. Not super related to Daniel, but just reminding us of what matters. Oh, I don't want... Oh. Verse 16, he told them a parable saying the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? Then he said, this is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. And God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared? I mean, even if you're on top of your palace looking at all that you have built, what does it matter? It matters nothing. You know? I'm kind of getting to that point where I don't know, maybe if I had heard it somewhere or thought it myself, but, you know, you guys can head back to Daniel 4. You can't take anything out of this life. You came in with nothing, you leave with nothing. And the only thing you have in this life that you can take is the relationships that you've built. That's it. Because people are the only eternal thing on the earth. So, God gives and God takes away. And God gave the king his kingdom. And he says, your goods will become the goods of someone else when you pass away. And that's just how it goes. Now, it doesn't mean that we're careless with our goods. You know, the wise man leaves an inheritance to his generation's generation, to his son's son, on to the third generation, right? But that's not the stuff that's going to last, you know? Now, I really appreciate that reminder because it's really easy to kind of get bogged down in the stuff, the work advancements and the piling of the goods and then building the barns to make room for the goods. I used to know this figure, but... you know, maybe don't look it up just now, but how many actual square miles of America is covered with storage units? What percentage of our land? Yeah, that would probably shock you, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yeah. It was Mike Ferguson at family camp said, at least in his where he lives in Texas, he says nobody parks their car in the garage. Now, he said he kind of feels like maybe he's the weird one because he parks his truck in the garage. Do you remember why he said nobody parks their car in the garage? Because all their stuff's in there, you know? I mean, we are so rich and so blessed, you know? And then there's some of us who there might be a use for that, you know, 10 years down the road, so then we got to hang on to it, you know? We just have so much stuff. And To each his own. But the only thing that you get to take with you are the relationships that you founded. And you don't get to take the relationships with those who don't make it. So that's kind of the goal is to, you know, I mean, I want Nebuchadnezzar to win. We want people to win because it's the only thing we can take. So I thought that was worth hitting. Back to Daniel chapter 4 here. Verse 34. But at the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and praised and honored him who lives forever. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. Yeah, a little tough to know kind of how this played out, right? He was an unreasoning animal, and then his reason returned to him. Just, that's all it says. But what I find very important is that at the end of that period, where did he look? He looked to heaven. So why is he looking at heaven? Well, if you go back to verse 31, while the word was in the king's mouth, I have built Babylon, blah, 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 a voice came from heaven. So it's probably the last thing he remembers. frankly, right? And plus, looking to God was the only way he was going to get his kingdom restored back to him, was recognizing the very thing that he said, okay, that in the middle of verse 34, God's dominion is an everlasting dominion. See, that was the requirement for Nebuchadnezzar to recognize in order for the tree to be returned back to him. Pretty cool picture for us, though. Sometimes we become a little unreasoning. We let our emotions get in the way. Maybe we become fleshly. Maybe we get worried about building a barn to put all of our stuff in, whatever it may be. And what's the only solution? Look to heaven. And then what do you know? That's what Colossians says. And he's like, come on, I told you, set your mind on things above. So I like that picture there. Verse 35, all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? I like that. I think I'm going to keep moving here just so we wrap up. Again, just showing God's authority and his power. And nobody gets to say, what have you done? You know, that just reminds me of Romans chapter 9. Right? You know, the pot doesn't say to the one who made him, why did you make me this way? Okay. Why should the clay not say that to the maker? Well, if the clay is saying that to the maker, what's the problem? The clay thinks he's the maker. Okay. I wanted a spout, you know, and you didn't give me one. You gave me a wide opening. And the point here is, if you have an appropriate appraisal of who God is and where true power lies and where true dominion comes from, where sovereignty is given and taken, if you have the right mental picture, you wouldn't dare say in the end of verse 35, what have you done? Or dare in Romans 9 say, why have you made me this way? See, those words in Romans 9 are reserved for the unrighteous. The unrighteous say that. Vessels of wrath. Prepared for destruction. I love that you guys know your Bibles. Those are words. So, you know, the connection there. That's why this line shows up. It makes sense. It just reminds me of Romans 9. Verse 36, at that time, my reason returned to me. Again, this is a recounting. He couldn't have said these things without his reason. Okay? This is a recounting. So he says, at that time, my reason returned to me. And my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. And my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out so that I was reestablished in my sovereignty and surpassing greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true and his ways just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. That was kind of the point. So glad he made it there. Some thoughts here as we wrap up this chapter. Someone asked me recently in a Bible study, and I know that I've shared this with you because I thought it was pretty intriguing. I've got it written down, so I'm probably going to have to pull it up here. But someone asked me, do we have, because we talk a lot about how there's archaeological evidence for the section of the Library of Ashurbanipal dedicated to, Yabi Yunus, to the prophet Jonah. We have all kinds of archaeological evidence showing it, the biblical history. And they said, do we have any Egyptian history? Do the Egyptians in their own history have an account of the plagues? And I thought, oh, okay, it's a good question, but didn't know the answer off the top of my head. So I went and did some digging, and I learned a couple interesting things. The answer is yes. What's that? That's what it is. Now, before I made it to that, one of the things that I do know from some of the videos that we've shown here, because there's like all kind, there's some sort of pillar that was found outside the Gulf of Aqaba that had Egyptian writing on it, and they still don't agree with what that thing says to this day. The Egyptian, what I'm trying to say is the Egyptian language is incredibly difficult to understand. Okay, they argue over what it means. So it's not like, when they go to Jericho and they're like, oh, yep, this pottery belongs here and this is what this manuscript says. They go to Egypt and everybody's just arguing over what any of it says. And you've seen Egyptian writing. I mean, up to interpretation, right? So that makes it difficult to truly nail down Egyptian history, which is why people fuss over the dates of the Exodus all the time. Okay, it's because of the inability to really nail it down in the Egyptian language. Now, thank the Lord that we've got other archaeological evidence in the Bible. I mean, we have way too many other things that confirm the date, the biblical date. But so the language is incredibly difficult to understand. Secondly, now this is where the historians come in. So it says, ancient Egyptian records typically focus on the success and achievement of the pharaohs. Shocker. What does that mean then? Maybe if you were the pharaoh in charge when 10 plagues devastated and destroyed the whole land and then never recovered, maybe that didn't make it into the third grade history book. That's the reality. Okay, so we have sections of the plagues recorded. We do not have all 10. Why not? Their history is usually reserved for the successes and achievements of the pharaohs. Why would that be? The pharaoh was thought to be a god, so you don't just write down that the god king bleeds. That didn't get written down. Okay, he lost to some Hebrew guy who walks around in a robe carrying a big stick. Okay, so they often, I'm going to read this here. They often omit events that might reflect negatively on the rulers. Therefore, if the plagues did occur, it's possible that they were not recorded in their entirety in Egyptian resources due to the nature of the historic record keeping in Egypt, which favored positive portrayals of the pharaoh. So, Jared, you want to say this word again? Ipuwer papyrus. Ipuwer. They record at least five of the plagues in detail, which is pretty cool. It's actually an old Egyptian poem written around, guess what, the same time as the Exodus. So what's that got to do with Nebuchadnezzar and Babylon? Well, is it possible then that Babylonian history would probably, typically like to portray the positive successes of the king and maybe not the downfalls, right? Would it shock you if you read Babylonian history and this section of the king's insanity maybe didn't make it into the history books? Okay? But that wouldn't shock me, because that's kind of, I'm just giving the Egyptian example to show that, I mean, that's kind of how it goes. So the idea was to paint the God King, because he had his statue made, right? Nebuchadnezzar had his statue made. The idea is to portray the God King in a positive light, not to write down all the terrible things. So having, you know, hair like eagle feathers and, you know, claw, you know, toenails like claws and eating grass and being all sweaty and smelly probably isn't something that he would want recorded. But look what we do have recorded, which I thought was really cool. This made it into the Babylonian archives, and it's actually in a museum in, I believe, India. There's a writing, historical inscription, in a museum that's written by Nebuchadnezzar himself. And in it, Nebuchadnezzar relates, now he says a four-year period, so that doesn't mean that the period of insanity was only 4 years. He just says that he records a period of 4 years where, referring to himself, he ceased to lay out buildings or to furnish with victims Merodach's altar or to clear out the canals for irrigation. So that's pretty significant. Now, that probably made no sense. So let's make sense of it. Nebuchadnezzar says that, like, this is Nebuchadnezzar's own writings, his own admissions, was that a four-year stretch went by where he didn't build any buildings. He didn't offer any offerings to his God on the altar and didn't even clean out the channels for irrigation. Okay. Now, you guys are familiar with the big ditch that runs down Broadwater. That didn't get cleaned out for a couple years. Do you guys remember what happened? You remember what happened to my neighborhood specifically? It flooded. That's why you clean out the channels. Okay, so for a king to say 4 years went and he didn't build a single building? 4 years went and not a single channel was prepared to make sure that water could flow so that the crops were irrigated, right? And then 4 years and is an abominable way to worship his God? He didn't offer sacrifices to his God? How is that possible? For that to be said of the king? In his own history, how is it possible? Because he was running around like a rabid dog for 7 years. And I think it's awesome. Because once again, history proves the biblical account. Right? You read this story and you're like, this guy became an animal. And I mean, did he really have like feathers? Or was his hair just really that matted, you know? All this stuff happened. And that's proof that it happened. Because a king doesn't get to be king if he's not offering up sacrifices to his God and clearing out the channels and continuing to build this mighty empire that he, you know, supposedly built. So, you know, we got a couple minutes here and we'll just finish early. Just to want to remind us that the Israelites go into Babylonian captivity. That's chapters 1 through 4. That also includes chapters 7 and 8. That's where Nebuchadnezzar's shift is going to end, and then Belteshazzar's shift is going to pick up. So that's where we're headed in chapters 7 and 8. We then have to go back to chapter 5, which numerically follows where we're at now, because that's where Belteshazzar's shift ends. And then that's when Babylon ceases, and that's when we'll make the hard shift here in Daniel to the Medo-Persian Empire and Darius and even a little bit of Cyrus here right at the end. So just a reminder why we're going through this the way that we're going through it. We will be in chapter 7 next week. Thanks for your attention.